Current state for Thursday. Welcome back, one and all. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. Coming up this hour, an interesting segment with a professor of psychiatry at the University of Michigan. Melvin McInnes joins us to discuss his work on a smartphone app that will help people diagnosed with bipolar disorder. It is a fascinating story and yet another story about all of the potential of smartphone applications. Also, I'll chat up the brand new CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Colin O'Mara was recently in Michigan. He stopped by the studio. We had a chance to talk, and it's very interesting to get his take on Michigan's particular challenges, where Michigan fits in nationally through the eyes of an environmentalist like Mr. O'Mara. So Colin O'Mara, lots more coming up before the hour is through. To start out our program, our famed cherry crop is just about finished ripening here in Michigan. Now, growers are preparing to harvest grapes in a couple of weeks. Michigan's wine industry is in a state of steady growth. This week, a team of judges came to East Lansing to cast their votes in the 37th annual Michigan Wine Competition. Current state's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us more. Not the first time you've covered the wine competition. I'll point out to our listeners it's an admirable sacrifice, Kevin.
You got to take one from the team sometimes. And, you know, each time I go, I have nary a drop, much to my chagrin. Michigan has more than 100 wineries, Mark, 107 actually. Most of them are concentrated in the Pinky, the Traverse City and the Leelanau Peninsula region. The judges came to Michigan State University Tuesday to evaluate the state's best wines. The medal ceremony will be held at the Kellogg Center at MSU next Thursday. And when I was there, I spoke with Linda Jones. She's the executive director of the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council, and she told me that the wine industry has seen huge changes here in the last 30 years.
Originally, when the industry started, we were making wine from native grape varieties that are used primarily for jams and jellies. And then as the industry has matured and evolved, they started planting hybrid varieties. And then in about the 1970s, we planted the European varieties, vinifera varieties, which are known to consumers. Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, those are the varieties that consumers are very familiar with. But until about 20 years ago, there weren't many plantings of those in Michigan. But now those are our dominant plantings, the vinifera European varieties. So that's one of the ways that the industry has changed dramatically in the last quarter century.
How does a discriminating consumer who really wants an educated opinion about what they're purchasing, to what degree do they pay attention to these competitions in terms of the homework they have to do?
Well, it is overwhelming as a consumer to go into the wine aisle in the store and see all of these choices facing you. And so competitions are a great way to pay attention to some of the award-winning wines. It's just a good subset of wines to watch for. The best way for people to understand what they like about wine is to go and visit tasting rooms and have a chance to taste many wines at once so they can compare and contrast, talk to the tasting room staff to help them understand what it is they like and dislike about wines.
This is early August. The harvest is coming up in a couple, 3 weeks. How are we looking?
Well, we had a pretty severe winter, as we all know here in Michigan, that lived through it, and we did take quite a hit in the yields. And some varieties were hurt worse than others. So depending on what varieties growers have and what part of the state they're located in, some people have complete loss of production on a particular variety in their location. Some people have been unaffected by the cold weather because they had very hardy varieties planted. But we're expecting about 50% of a crop statewide on all the varieties. That's what makes wine so interesting. Every year is a little bit different. The characteristics of the wine are different, and that's why people like to follow the industries to understand those nuances. It's like limited edition art. You only get to do it once. You only get to make wine from that acre of Merlot this year once, and then that's all you get.
So even though your 2004 Cabernet Franc was splendid, was fantastic, there's no guarantee that your 2014 Cabernet Franc is going to even come close. It sounds like it's very up to chance.
Very much so, and that's why competitions like this are very important, because we have that exact situation where we have had wineries that won our biggest awards for a variety 5 years ago. They submit a more recent vintage and doesn't guarantee that it's always going to do well every year. So much it depends on the vineyard management practices that they use in the vineyards.
I'm Joe Borello. I'm president of Tasters Guild International.
When you come to events like this, what are some of the basic elements you're looking for?
Oh, a lot has to do with the variety. And so we're looking for full flavor. We're looking for balance of sugar and acids and, you know, that kind of a thing.
Todd Steiner. I am an enologist at Ohio State University, so I do research on wine.
You're a brave man setting foot here.
Yeah, I know. Hey, go Big Ten, so that's all right.
What are you sampling right now?
We're doing oak Chardonnays.
And do you know which particular ones and where they come from?
Everything's blind, which it should be, so we can guess maybe a little bit on acidity, what region of the state it might be, but you know, basically, as Joe mentioned, we're looking for varietal character, balance of fruit, oak, and acid. You don't want anything to stick out too much over another.
How and why does one become a wine judge, or affectionately in the industry, a cork dork?
Well, you definitely have to enjoy it. So, but I think the love of wine is definitely increasing. More wineries are coming aboard on each state. And, you know, I think it's one of our jobs to make sure that we can give as much feedback to the wineries. And if that's through medals, then, you know, they're well deserving. That's a great way to mention to the consumer it's a good wine to drink.
At one table near the back of the room, I met Amanda Danielson. She's a restaurateur in Traverse City, and there was something not quite right with the wines she and her team had just sampled.
They were submitted as a level of dryness where they were actually quite sweeter, and they were disqualified as such because the category is very specific as to how much residual sugar is permitted if you're going to label it as brut.
And everybody at this table could tell right away there was something amiss?
Instantly. We actually paused for a moment, and as you know, as a captain, I never interrupt the tasting of the initial flight unless it seems that there's something wrong. Unanimously, we agreed that both of the first two wines in that last flight, there was something wrong, and then we brought it to the attention of the organizers, and they handled it immediately.
So this was not a collective, spontaneous taste bud malfunction?
No, it was not at all. This was, you know, years of beer drinking that has led us to believe that sparkly things, when they're misrepresented, should not be judged in a category in which they don't belong.
So 164 has a gold, 152 bronze, 185 gold.
Dick Peterson.
Well, I live in Napa Valley, and I've been a winemaker out there for more than 50 years, and I'm retired now, but my own brand is Richard Grant. Grant is my middle name, so I can say Richard Grant. The golds obviously stand out. The silvers are pretty darn good wines, too, but when it's no award, you don't really want to encourage it.
Okay, now here's a really basic question. When you're tasting wine for a period of time, how do you cleanse your palate so that the wine you're drinking now doesn't get itself confused with the wine you just had 10 seconds ago?
The big secret is don't ever swallow for any reason. Just rinse your mouth out with water, and we use carbonated water and spit it out commonly, and we do that. And the other thing is those olives, the Graber olives are terrific for that. Just have an olive every now and then, and it keeps your mouth clean. The only way to really ruin your taste for the day is start swallowing, and then you're no good in 15 minutes. You're no good at tasting anymore. It has nothing to do with the alcohol. It's just that it screws up your taste ability.
301.
Silver.
Bronze. Solid silver.
Okay.
Anything to talk about? Doug Frost is the name.
I'm a
master sommelier, master of wine that does a lot of teaching and writing. Michigan is now a very consistent source of lovely, delicate, delicious white wines in general. I think Riesling, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris can all be really relied upon, but there's a number of other grapes that may, with emphasis on the conditional, may turn out to be really lovely here. Grunewettliner, I'm pushing for Albarino. I think that should happen here, but there are other grapes as well. And there's some lovely hybrid grapes up here. Vignal had some delicious Vignal today. Red wine has been a mixed bag up here for a long time, and with 12 being the sort of representation of most of the red wines here, it's a pretty good year to show red wine. So we found some really lovely reds.
Next Thursday is a reception here at MSU that will see the award winners being presented their medals.
Yes, we have a public reception. We love to invite members of the public to come and attend and sample the gold medal winning wines from the competition. We do trophy presentations in the rear courtyard at the Kellogg Hotel and Conference Center at 5 o'clock, and then we proceed into the Big Ten room where we have over 100 wines that are the best wines from this competition available for people to sample. And tickets are available by going to michiganwines.com website, and you can order them online. Tickets are available at the door, but advance tickets are at a slight discount.
Linda Jones is the Executive Director of the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council. Thanks, Linda.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And Mark, just a couple of hours after I finished producing this story, the Michigan Wine Competition awardees were named. In total, 52 wines won gold medals. 8 of them achieved the coveted Best in Class. And you can see those winners online at michiganwines.com.
Great, Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Last month, it was announced that MSU's Lesbian, Bisexual, Gay, Transgender Resource Center had received an anonymous gift of $1 million. The gift has been called the Support, Outreach, Action, and Respect Fund, or SOAR Fund. It's the largest donation in the history of MSU's LGBT Resource Center. Here to tell us more is Deanna Hurlburt, the director of the Resource Center here on campus. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning.
First of all, congratulations. $1 million donation is pretty exciting. I know the donors want to remain anonymous, but what can you tell us about this?
Sure. Well, what I can tell you about it is that I have been able to meet with the donors, and we've been in touch with them for some time. And it's really an extraordinary gift. I mean, $1 million is a wowing figure.
Yeah.
And we've been very fortunate. I mean, $1 million gets the attention of folks like you and others and is a great place to have to start conversations. But we have been very fortunate to be the beneficiaries of many large gifts within the last 14 months. Mm. I think that's a reflection of a couple of things. First off, it's a reflection of the university doing a much better job of appropriately engaging with LGBT alumni. And the second piece is that it's acknowledging that Michigan State is really on the verge and positioned to be a global leader in LGBT student support, climate, and developing folks for service around the world.
As you said, the Resource Center probably won't get the money for some time. What does the gift
Correct.
Mean right now, though?
What the gift means right now is, I think, of two things. I think it's healing for LGBT alum who were a part of Michigan State during long periods of time when their existence wasn't necessarily acknowledged. For those alum who give the gift, it's a way of saying, the way that I experienced the world when I was a college student, I don't want anybody else to have to deal with that, to have to go through that. And the other thing that it does is it's validating for all LGBT people and people who love LGBT people to say that that their existence, the existence of us, is important to the institution, and that there are some unique support needs that are going to continue despite the recent advances in policy.
Deanna Hurlburt is the director of MSU's LGBT Resource Center. We're talking about a recent $1 million donation that was announced to the center. Describe your mission for us.
Sure. The LGBT Resource Center exists for, I think, of two purposes. One part, and actually the lion's share of what we do, is prepare all students to thrive in a world that's diverse, and diverse in ways that they're not always prepared for when they get to campus. So ally engagement and development are educational programs. A little known fact is that about 85% of the students and the folks that our office works with are heterosexually identified. And that's because if you want to change climate, change the institution, you have to work to develop allies and do broader education. The other piece of our mission is making sure that lesbian, bisexual, gay, transgender students, those students that are questioning, their identities, that they have an outstanding Spartan experience. And those are the direct support services that we offer and advocacy for those students.
So you're reaching out to the straight student population here, mm-hmm. in an attempt to make them aware of these challenges and to hopefully line up their support.
That's true. Yeah. I would another way to frame the work that we do is that we do broad-based education around sexuality and gender as a whole. Unfortunately, our public school system is really, both in the state of Michigan and broadly, is kind of terrible about sexuality education and sexual health education. It's very limited. So there are ways in which people just don't know about the spectrum of sexuality and gender, mm. and they don't know about the fluidity of sexuality and gender that is a reality that doesn't get talked about.
One of your programs is a 6-week course for incoming LGBT students. What does that cover exactly?
Sure. It's open to allies as well, and a good number of the folks who have participated in that program are straight identified. And most of the time, those heterosexual students are coming into the program because their social network has been largely connected to the LGBT community. They were involved in GSAs. So what it's about is meeting the unique support needs for incoming LGBT students. We know that students who feel connected to the university, students who have friends here, do better as students and are more likely to stay. So we create the opportunity for those students to get to meet others and make friends. And the existence of our office, this special first year experience program, it says that you exist and that the university values you and we are invested in you. And that helps those students feel connected to the institution as well as to one another, which makes them more likely to stay here and do well here.
How has the climate changed for LGBT college students recently? I mean, what issues do LGBT students face today that they may not have faced a decade ago, let's say?
Oh, that's a great question and an insightful question, is that there are challenges that folks face now that we didn't necessarily have, weren't as common years ago. And the first is that people are becoming self-aware of their sexuality and their gender identity at earlier ages. It's more common now that students are out before they get to campus. And for a long time, my work was around helping students deal with coming out. It's no longer the case. Now the work is largely working with the institution to get the institution up to speed with the needs of these students, who are also millennials.
Besides the course for first-year students, describe one other service you offer that you're really proud of that's important.
Sure. We have what I call the family room, which is the walk-in space of the LGBT Resource Center. And that space is critically important. We found it to be especially important for those students that may have a harder time finding a social niche elsewhere. And it is a lounge, essentially, where folks can spend time. We also have, in addition to that, we do individual mentorship with students, where I call them motivational interviews, where we help students identify their goals and the steps to achieve those goals. And we do that with any student. Sort of a case management approach.
Okay.
A concierge service. When I meet with students and at our welcome event, we let students know that anybody who walks in the door becomes one of my kids, one of our kids, and that whether it's about financial aid, issues at home, a relationship problem, or the shoelace broke and they need help with that, that we offer concierge services.
How many MSU students identify as LGBT? Do you know? We often hear, 40,000 MSU students. I mean, do you have any idea how many of those identify as LGBT?
No. I mean, really, we don't keep, it's not data that's currently collected by the institution. But what we do say is that numbers are probably the same as they are in the general population. And estimates for that go anywhere between 3 to 10 to 15% of the population.
How many is it known? Do you have any idea how many LGBT students graduate from MSU?
No, which is hugely problematic. I think one of the challenges for the university is going to be to have the courage to start collecting that data in appropriate way. There's been some hesitation to record identity-based data, in part because at one point in time there were issues of privacy and concerns that people would be insulted if you asked them about their sexual orientation and their gender identity. I'm of the belief that for students that are here now and the students that are coming, they're more insulted if you don't acknowledge that their identity as lesbian, bisexual, gay, or transgender persons is important. So until we start to collect that information in our university demographics at admissions and then throughout the time that students are here, we're not going to know.
What's the resistance? Where is the resistance coming from to that?
Well, part of it is it's just the investment it takes in terms of IT, database technologies. Okay. That's, you know, there's that piece. But the other piece is, again, there's resistance to collect the information because it's seen as sensitive and private. And I believe that that can be overcome by allowing the information to be optional, as other data. But also, people are afraid that it will cause insult to students if they ask that question. My experience has been that students now, they don't even blush at the question. We, as people in our 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, blush at the question, but the kids don't.
Mm. Do you see a day when that may change? Might the day arrive pretty soon when we do start tracking that?
Yeah, I think that I think we have that. There's the will on many levels to make that happen. I think that it's a matter of it could be any minute now. It just takes a few people in the right places to decide that they're going to ask those questions.
You alluded to the fact that more young people are coming out in high school and they're already adjusting to their identity by the time they arrive at Michigan State. What does that say about the overall climate for LGBT students here at MSU?
Yeah. What it says is that overwhelmingly, Michigan State has an excellent climate, and we have for a long time. Where the rub has come in is having that Michigan State University is in the middle of the state of Michigan, which is a very conservative state. It is what I would think of as a repressive political climate. Our public policies here are not just null; they are destructive to LGBT persons and families. So Michigan, the state of Michigan, is also one of the most segregated in the country. And most of our students here come from the state of Michigan. And that means we have a student population that isn't experienced and versed with talking about difference, whether it's race, ethnicity, class, culture, immigration, or sexuality and gender. So we institutionally, I think, we have student culture and climate that has some unique challenges for talking about difference. So when we have all these public policy changes that are happening so rapidly, a huge number of students who are coming here, who are already out, who expect to be acknowledged and to be serviced as LGBT persons, that I'm concerned about pending backlash and how that might manifest.
Well, it's interesting you bring this up because, broadly, we seem to be moving in the direction of more acceptance and legal rights for LGBT citizens. In just a few minutes, in fact, we're going to have an update on yesterday's hearings at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals on gay marriage bans in four states, one of them Michigan. But you're wary that this public debate might bring about a backlash. Tell us more about that.
Sure. First, anytime that there is a debate about civil rights, anytime there's a debate that's identity-based in the media, so whether it's marriage, don't ask, don't tell, other kinds of institutional policies, you're essentially putting into the public debate someone's humanity and the legitimacy of their family and their relationships as parents, as partners, and as children of LGBT folks.
It invites a reaction as well, which is, and there's risks involved in that. Is that part of what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just within the last few days, I've heard of three incidents in the Lansing area of people being verbally harassed, verbally assaulted, completely unprovoked. Two of the instances are folks that I know personally. And I have not heard that in many years. This is unusual. So I think, you know, I'm a little bit concerned about what that's going to look like for us coming back.
Deanna Hurlburt is the director of MSU's LGBT Resource Center. Last month, the center became the recipient of a $1 million bequest from anonymous donors. Thanks for joining us, Deanna.
Thank you.
Good luck. Well, from campus to the courtroom is where we go now. Yesterday, a federal appeals court in Cincinnati began hearing arguments involving state bans against same-sex marriage. Michigan is one of those states. Supporters and opponents of same-sex marriage are watching the proceedings closely in the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta was there and joins us now to talk about day one in court. Welcome back, sir.
First day and last day that unlike other court hearings, appellate hearings aren't full-blown trials that go on for days and days and days. Each side gets a limited amount of time. Usually the arguments are about an hour, which is what Michigan and Ohio got in this case, 1.5 hour for each side. Kentucky and Tennessee, both sides just had 15 minutes each. So it goes pretty quickly.
Still, you describe this as a months-long process. How does that play out?
Actually, years-long process. If you go back and look at how just the Michigan case started, which was an adoption rights case that was expanded to tackle Michigan's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. And, you know, we saw in that trial in Detroit that the arguments focused on the research and the effects of same-sex marriage on families and particularly in children. And that really wasn't, it was part of the arguments. And remember, you can't delve into a lot when you have just a half hour, but it was part of the arguments. But really the arguments in Cincinnati focused a lot more on whether or not now is the time for courts, for the legal system, to make a determination on whether or not states should be allowed to ban same-sex marriage and whether marriage for same-sex couples is a constitutional right. That you had the states, actually, Michigan and Ohio, and to a lesser degree Kentucky and Tennessee, going in and arguing that these were political decisions that were made or backed by the voters and that the system ought to give deference to those voters. And one of the judges, a Bush appointee, Judge Sutton, even seemed at least intrigued by the argument. He spent a lot of time, you know, wondering out loud whether or not it would be better for the country, better for society, if we just waited for a consensus to develop around this, that there are more ballot drives where one side has to go over and persuade the other side, as opposed to having a judicially imposed decision. The argument on the other side in both the Michigan and the Ohio cases was no. We can't wait because children are being hurt right now. Families are being hurt right now. Children in particular are being denied two-parent families, the benefits that go with that, both emotional, psychological, sociological, as well as financial and legal. And same-sex couples are also being discriminated against, being denied basic rights, not just to marry, but, an attorney for Ohio. Ohio said, look, you know, a death certificate is our last record of our time here on earth. And right now, if you're in a same-sex marriage in any of these states with bans, that the very last record of your existence is basically a lie.
In a story you filed, you referred to yesterday as a legal palooza. What was the atmosphere in the courtroom?
And the atmosphere in the courtroom was very staid. The atmosphere outside, it wasn't bedlam by any means, but there were a lot of people milling about. Weirdest moment was when a person in a bright yellow hazmat suit apparently demonstrating against the government's response to what's happening with the Ebola virus photobombed the photo op with all of the advocates who were arguing for same-sex marriage in the court.
Oh my goodness!
So these do come, accompanied with a certain a sense of spectacle,
certain circus atmosphere. Was it the courtroom was filled? I presume.
Packed shoulder to shoulder. That the staff at the circuit told me that they'd never had anything like it. They had to set up extra chairs in the back. People were assigned numbers to get in. A few people slept on the courthouse steps overnight just so that they could be first in line for the very few tickets that were available for the general public to see it. I got to sit in the back of the courtroom in one of the media spots.
Well, I know it was a late night for you last night, Rick. We appreciate your joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore with a quick reminder. An unwanted car that's given you years of good service can do one final good deed. You can donate it to WKAR. You could help pay for your favorite WKAR programs like Current State, like Morning Edition. To learn more, visit our website, please, WKAR.org, and we thank you. The National Wildlife Federation has a new president and CEO. Colin O'Mara was recently in Michigan for an environmental tour of the Detroit area and came by the WKAR studios to talk. For a CEO, he's on the young side, in his 30s. I asked him what environmental values he brings to this position that might be different from someone in their 50s or 60s.
Throughout my life, I was fortunate to grow up in a family that really valued nature. And I think at the same time, I grew up in a cohort that kind of, there are two types of kids. There's kids that played outside, and there's kids that played video games and played in their computers and things like that. And the challenge is those kids are having kids now. And so at a time when we're facing some of the greatest conservation challenges in the globe's history, in Michigan's history, you have a citizenry that's actually less engaged with nature in a personal way than probably any time in American history. And so I think I bring that connection with nature, and also kind of knowing that we need that connection to actually overcome some of these challenges, because otherwise it's just an academic exercise.
You did some organizing for John McCain's first run for president. You've also served as the executive of the Onondaga County Democratic Committee in New York State. Having worked for both, what are your thoughts on how the major political parties in this country are currently handling the environmental issues that concern groups like the National Wildlife Federation?
I think when the conversations turn to place-based projects, so restoring the Great Lakes, doing work in the Gulf of Mexico, trying to work in the Colorado River, the partisan labels tend to fall away. When you talk about national issues that started affecting the entire country, the politics dominate everything and kind of destroy the potential for consensus. But if you look back 40 years ago, the Clean Air Act passed unanimously. When Nixon first vetoed the Clean Water Act, it was overridden with the overwhelming majority to override the veto. And so, throughout our history, we've come together around these issues, and it's really just the last 20 or 30 years where we've been kind of ripped apart by what I call the 10% at the extremes, instead of focusing on the 80% that we agree on. But the fact that the Michigan delegation, regardless of party, can come together to get funding for the Great Lakes to do great conservation work shows there is a conservation ethic, but we need to localize it and kind of stay out of some of the nationwide debates that would get us into trouble.
The animal lovers out there will want to know the main species the National Wildlife Federation is most focused on right now.
So in the state of Michigan, we're concerned about the declining moose population. The scientists in the wildlife agency decided that the populations had dropped so much that they couldn't have a hunting season anymore. We're seeing impacts on loon populations as both from botulism and also from other water impacts in the state. We're seeing a lot of invasive species, obviously the Asian carp issue that's continuing to impact ecosystems within the Great Lakes. There's also just a series of other impacts on habitats that we're seeing up and down the state and across the region that are completely connected to climate impacts that are affecting the hunting and fishing experience, that are affecting just folks' ability to go outdoors. And so we're really focused on kind of protecting those species and making their habitat more resilient, and at the same time figuring out more ways to expose folks to nature to build the base of kind of the conservation ethic to actually protect those very species.
Hmm. Colin O'Mara is our guest. Colin is the new president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. And you're listening to Current State on WKAR. Even though you're the National Wildlife Federation, part of your mission is finding solutions to global warming as well. Given all the environmental issues that affect our wildlife. Why are you choosing to focus on climate change?
So I think that when you look at all the different threats to wildlife, pollution, different types of other of human activity, the potential long-term impacts from climate change are pretty significant. Now, when you look at wetlands being depleted of resource in places like North Dakota, when you're looking at the forest fires in the Midwest, you're looking at the droughts in the Southwest, you're looking at, you know, some of these hurricanes on the East Coast, the impacts of climate on these individual species and their habitat is pretty significant. And so we're really focused on the wildlife piece of the climate challenge and trying to figure out ways to make sure that those habitats are more resilient so the species are protected. One of the things that is happening across the globe right now is that we are seeing more and more species populations decline as a result of climate impacts, and the potential for extinction of many species is greater than probably any time in the last several thousand years.
You also have a mission to get kids outside and more acquainted with the natural world. You kind of alluded to this a minute ago. Why do you feel this is important?
So I have a two-year-old daughter, and you know, she's bombarded all the time with, you know, different types of electronic devices and things like that. And there's a connection with nature that, especially at a young age, helps crystallize the mind. Actually, will improve cognitive skills. It'll help with critical thinking. It'll help build leadership skills. It helps with school performance. It helps reduce, you know, the potential for childhood obesity. And related diseases like childhood diabetes.
There are links to all of those benefits.
Absolutely. And just the time of playing outside. And so the average American kid right now is spending about 50 hours a week in front of some kind of screen. And that's outside of school. They might be spending another 10 hours in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And only minutes a week outside in unstructured play. Compare that to 40 years ago in my grandparents' generation, the numbers were almost the exact opposite. And so, you know, if you lose that connection, you look at challenges around healthcare, you look at challenges on school performance, look at challenges around kind of the environmental ethic that then leads to kind of an informed citizenry and a scientific literate citizenry, a lot of the challenges that we have as a country get back to this lack of connection for children and nature.
Did you have a wild place when you were a kid that informed how you viewed the natural world?
Yeah, I was fortunate. I grew up in the house of an elementary school teacher. So my mom and dad were both teachers, and my dad was later in the military. And so we were outside all the time. And so I remember, you know, waiting for my issue of Ranger Rick magazine from the National Wildlife Federation and, you know, doing those activities as a family. We had woods in the backyard, and we had, you know, great state and local parks in, within, you know, a few minutes' drive. And so we were outside all the time in Syracuse, New York. In the Finger Lakes region.
All right.
Yeah. And we were outside all the time. And that was the way we spent time as a family. And I think it ingrained an appreciation that's obviously stayed with me till today.
Are there issues associated with the Midwest, with Michigan, that you feel have really gone beyond our region and are now affecting the national dialogue on the environment?
I do. I think the leadership that's been shown around the Great Lakes Compact in particular, and kind of showing how different entities, in this case, across two different countries, have come together to try to restore such an amazing resource, creates a model that could be replicated in other parts of the country. I think the work around invasive species, in particular, in the Asian carp issue, and the way that folks from both parties have come together to actually try to deal with this is another great example of potential leadership. And then I think also there's been an embrace by the Snyder administration and by politicians of both parties around the economic benefits of protecting these incredibly wild places and looking at the tourism benefits and trying to promote the Upper Peninsula, trying to promote, you know, some of these great waterways in western or central Michigan, looking at, you know, ways to really kind of connect nature. And if you look at the work recently trying to restore Belle Island and having, you know, the state play a bigger role there, an incredible sized park. I mean, it's a park that's bigger than Central Park, right close to a major population center. I mean, to have that kind of resource reclaimed and being able to say across the country, if they did it in Michigan, we can do it in some other places, I think does create a model that's replicable. So I think folks should be pretty proud of the work that's going on here. A lot more work to do, but I think it's because the hunters and the anglers and the birders and the gardeners and everyone kind of work together generally to try to get some of these bigger issues done.
And what about the other direction? Conversely, what national or world environmental issues do you see as having the most impact on those of us here in the Midwest?
I think when you look at some of the big impacts, some of the storms, some of the impacts around water quality related to climate. I mean, I think there are some big global trends that will affect, whether it's more intense precipitation, more heat. I mean, things that will fundamentally alter the amazing habitat that you do have in the state. So I think there's things like that. I think there's also some lessons that we could learn from some other parts of the country for potentially even the revitalization of cities like Detroit and Flint. I mean, I think there's places that have adopted, kind of natural resource conservation and natural resource infusion into communities as a way to help bring life back into those communities. And I'll be visiting a series of sites in downtown Detroit. These are big facilities that, you know, have fairly high levels of pollution and some of the highest rates of asthma around for the folks that live in those neighborhoods around there. One's a big incinerator. And in a lot of other parts of the country, folks have moved away from that technology more towards recycling, things that create more jobs, more opportunities for manufacturing, and obviously a lot less pollution, a lot better health outcomes for residents. So I think there's lessons like that that, you know, have, you know, are national and international in terms of like the way folks are thinking about the way of managing waste more effectively that if adopted here in Michigan actually could have some pretty good benefits.
Colin O'Mara is the new president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. A pleasure to have you on the show. Good luck.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for everything.
State from 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. In a world where there seems to be an app for anything and everything, smartphone technology may now be expanding into the realm of mental health treatment. A team of University of Michigan researchers is working to develop a smartphone app that would help people living with bipolar disorder. Melvin McInnes, a professor and researcher at the University of Michigan School of Psychiatry, is one of the key developers of the Priori app. He joins us today to tell us more about what the app aims to do and what it could mean for the future of bipolar disorder treatment. Professor, thanks for joining us here on Current State. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Just so we could have everybody on the same page here, give us a good layperson's working definition of bipolar disorder. What are some of its main characteristics?
Well, bipolar disorder is an illness that affects the mood, it affects our mental energy, it affects the way that individuals feel, their energy. It ranges from depressive episodes where the individual has no energy, difficulties concentrating, profoundly overwhelmed with sadness, through to hypomanic or manic episodes where the energy is revved up. There is a diminished need for sleep, a pathologically diminished need for sleep. The energy is, as I said, wound up. The affect is really charged up, and the individual may be speaking very loud and have misguided volitions and doing activities or engaging activities that are forthright dangerous.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the project you're working on then. How might an app monitor mood swings?
Well, one of the features of mood disorders is found in the speech. So an individual who experiences either a depression episode or a manic episode will often have changes in the way that their speech sounds. And so very often a family member will tell us that they can hear something is amiss because they just sound different. They're either speaking way too fast and going all over the place, or they're speaking way too slowly and often difficult to really follow. So our hypothesis is that there may be features in the way that an individual speaks that could be detected by computational methods using computerized analysis of the acoustics of speech that would essentially predict an impending change of moods.
How interesting. Professor Melvin McInnes is our guest. He's researching a smartphone app that may assist people who have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. What's the status of your project right now? Where are you with this?
Well, we know that, clearly we know that speech changes when individuals are in manic episodes or depressed episodes, and it's been demonstrated that when you take someone into a studio lab, you can record their speech, you can identify features of acoustics that associate with moods. But what we really don't know is if we can use smartphone technology to capture speech on the fly, if you will, in the course of the daily activities of the individual using their phone, and whether we can use that speech to be analyzed and identify features that would predict mood changes. So what we're doing, essentially, is that we've developed a program that captures the speech or records the speech on a cell phone. It encrypts it and sends it to a central server where it's analyzed, features of the acoustics are researched to identify features that would essentially associate with mood and potentially predict mood. So what we want to be able to do is predict mood. What we're able to do now is we're able to identify when somebody is having a mood disorder or sailing into a manic episode or a depressed episode. And so that's essentially the status of the research right now. And what our next goal is to see is whether we can accurately predict changes and subsequently either alert the patient or their family or their care provider to intervene and prevent these episodes.
Very interesting. What was the inspiration for this project? When and how did you get this idea?
Well, the inspiration, as a medical researcher, my inspiration comes from the individuals that I care for. And over the past several years, we've been engaging a large number of individuals in a longitudinal study of bipolar disorder that's sponsored by the Heinz C. Prechter Bipolar Research Fund here at the University of Michigan. And so in engaging with these individuals with bipolar disorder and engaging with their families, the families will say, you know, I could just hear there was something going on because I could hear it in their voice. And there was a change in just the way that they interacted with me and the way that their voice sounded. And so our hypothesis derived essentially from working with patients that we take care of and thinking through how can we identify ways and use the existing technology to be able to predict when somebody is headed for a crisis. So if we can do that and prevent the catastrophic consequences of bipolar disorder, which include suicide and all sorts of problems and consequences in so many different personal realms of the individual's life, that would go a long way to preventing the disorder and preventing the consequences of it. So that drives us.
Are you blazing a trail with this, or are there other apps out there that try to help people with mental health conditions like bipolar disorder?
There are many apps out there that are available for the individual to help help them manage the bipolar disorder. But what the apps are, that are out there, if you will, are applications that provide a basis for the individual to interact and monitor their mood themselves. And I don't know whether you've used a Fitbit or something like that, but the average person will use it for 3 months or so, and then you kind of put it on the shelf. What we're blazing a trail with here is using the application in a manner such that the individual only has to have their mobile device, their phone, with them. And so they really don't have to do anything other than use their device, and most of us will use our phone on a regular basis. And so we just have to have a very short snippet of speech of the individual to be able to monitor and assess the acoustic features of their speech.
So should this technology really take off and develop, will it change treatment practices and procedures for people with the disorder?
We believe it will, and that's why we call it Priori, because it's a method and a technology to help us prioritize those individuals that need care at any given time. So if you think of the state of Michigan, that there are 10 million people in the state of Michigan, 1% of them have bipolar 1 disorder, which means that there are 100,000 people in our state with bipolar 1 disorder. And so if we can use technology such as this to prioritize those individuals that need care today or relatively quickly, we could use this technology to get them in to see their healthcare provider and make the appropriate interventions to prevent untoward episodes. But I want to emphasize, of course, that this is research, and this is what we do at the university level, is to think deep thoughts and engage individuals in research. But we're very optimistic about this, and we're very optimistic that this will ultimately help individuals, and it will be very helpful, we believe, in reaching out to underserved communities and populations, because most people are carrying a cell phone.
What do you think this app will look like? And if all your trials are successful, if this unfolds satisfactorily to you, mm-hmm. when might we be looking at this?
Well, I have the application on my cell phone myself, and so I'm one of the individuals using it. And you really totally forget that you're actually using it. What we're setting about to do at this particular moment is to do a clinical trial of several hundred individuals, engage them with this technology, and follow them over a period of time. So individuals with bipolar disorder that have what we call rapid cycling, in other words, their moods are always or frequently changing. And so if we can demonstrate that this is effective in helping individuals monitor their moods, then we believe that there will be strong interest to support this going forward and really get this out to the front line of medical health care. We've also pointed out to others is that, speech is a very important biological marker. When you talk to your friends, your relatives, and you hear them talk just on the phone, you get a sense of how they're doing. So maybe mm-hmm. speech is a really good marker just of health status changes. When we're sick, when we have the flu, you don't sound all that great on the phone. And you can tell, when a family member is ill just by listening to them say a few words.
So you're confident that this may have broader applications in the future, technology like this?
Well, I'm confident, but we're the people that are working on it, so we're very enthusiastic about our work. And so, but we appreciate that it needs to stand the test of time and research, and we have very, skeptical statisticians that we work with on a regular basis who challenge us regularly to make sure that that everything is valid and stands the test of time. So we have a very strong team here that encompasses researchers in the College of Engineering here at the University of Michigan, and we're working with other individuals in a number of other schools here, the School of Information, and that to really give this a really thorough testing. And so we're very excited about it.
Very good. The University of Michigan working on a smartphone app that would help people living with bipolar disorder. One of those is Professor Melvin McInnes, a professor at the University of Michigan Department of Psychiatry. Many thanks for joining us, Professor, and good luck.
Thank you so much.
And that's our program for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, be looking for us broadcasting live from the Great Lakes Folk Festival starting at 6 p.m. in East Lansing. Have a great day. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.